Welcome to Alternatives, a podcast about alternative culture and its possibilities, or lack thereof.
Welcome to Alternatives, a podcast about alternative culture. It is JG Michaels and me, Derek Varn. We are part of the Inside Zero Books Network. I think that's a thing. And we're going to talk about Matt Taibbi. Somehow that's related. So I'm going to let JG make the argument for why it's actually related to what we talk about on this podcast. And then I'm going to make fun of Matt Taibbi, probably. Let's go.
Well, I think the biggest point for like wanting to talk about Taibbi is that a lot of his recent output, particularly his latest book, Insane Clown President and The Great Derangement, I think they both had a sort of intermingling with alternative cultures or trying to sparse out his alternative movements like the 9/11 truth movement and sort of, you know, fringe elements of the political subcultures.
So you think Taibbi was onto a pulse there that has sort of not gone away and kind of developed out of the late 90s, maybe even going back to the 60s and 70s. What Taibbi, though, has really, what makes him interesting to me, because I generally don't find pop culture progressives who write for Rolling Stone magazine be particularly interesting. Taibbi's an exception. His history with, like, say, Glenn Greenwald, when he was going to be part of The Intercept, and that he didn't, you know, really mesh well with it. I believe he was going to be part of The Intercept. Am I wrong about that?
No, I believe you're right about that, yeah.
And I find it fascinating that Taibbi didn't mesh well with Greenwald because they were both critics of the mainstream of the Democratic Party, but also Taibbi was a pretty strong critic of the fringe ends of the Democratic Party as well. So I've read The Great Derangement, and he's written Insane Crown President, and then his most recent book, actually, is I Can't Breathe, which I haven't had a chance to look at. So I'm speaking in ignorance of that one, and I've poked around Insane Clown President. So why is Taibbi not a relic of the Bush era like so many others of his ilk? I mean, I think a lot of, you go and read a lot of the political bloggers who started at the same time as him, like the people who wipe for Wonk Ed, are all the political end of Gawker Media, all that stuff is sort of not relevant anymore, and probably hasn't been during most of the Obama years, really. So what do we have now? I mean, what makes Taibbi different? And the subtext for this is you and I both think Rolling Stone is going down, right?
Right. For me, Taibbi is sort of this, well, everyone always compares him to being like the heir apparent of Hunter S. Thompson. I don't know if that's exactly true, but what I think is interesting about Taibbi is the media self-criticism that he does, especially in Insane Clown President. I found that really interesting. I think it would be interesting to see more of that in mainstream media. But I do think Rolling Stone is sort of this passing relic of a bygone era. I know they're having monetary problems now, and they're sort of not transitioning as well to the print age. So it'll be interesting to see how Taibbi manages to transition now from that.
Yeah, so let's talk about that for a second. My last time I talked about the transition out of the print era into the digital era, I was talking about the death of the New Republic. And the New Republic's still around, but it reads a lot more like center-left Salon, clickbait, you know. In fact, I recently I've actually felt like BuzzFeed writes better articles than the New Republic does. And of those magazines, the only ones that have held on is Harper's has become less and less relevant. I don't really know why. And The Atlantic has managed to stay pretty good from a sound content standard, actually doing investigative journalism and all that. Rolling Stone's had a couple of big, big debacles that have complicated its situation on top of not knowing how to transition to the world of Wire. So what do you make of that? I mean, let's go into a little bit more depth here. Why do you think that Taibbi is still relevant even though the organ that he works for is probably dead to the world? And we can talk about a couple of things that the Rolling Stone has really screwed up on in regards to journalism.
Like I said, I think what for me makes Taibbi relevant is the self-criticism that he levels at media in his work. But there is an element of just, at times, he does feel like a relic of the Bush era. I don't know if you'd agree with that.
Oh, I do. I think I think there are times where his writing is kind of hard to strike now. And saying Crime President was interesting because it reminded me... You remember Greg Palast?
Yes, yes. Yeah, I liked Greg Palast when I was like a teenager. You know, right. Yeah. I read him a lot.
So that was my early 20s. Like, he came and spoke at my college and got booed. because I was in a state college in Georgia that was fairly conservative. But Taibbi kind of reminds me of Palast, and Palast has also just not been relevant. I'm surprised that Taibbi isn't writing for The Guardian, because that's where those Bush-era people who can't get jobs in the States tend to go. But I find it interesting, because while we're back in a time where, you know, you have Republican dominance, it isn't the same time. I mean, one of the things about now... And maybe this is how Taibbi is more relevant than, say, Palast, is that for all the smoke the Trump administration has been putting out, the changes to the American government have been mostly in their inability to staff it. I mean, it's very similar, actually, to the first 2 years of the Obama administration, where Obama had a supermajority in the Senate, the likes of which no party had seen since the 60s, and then couldn't do anything with it except for kind of the ACA. And I say kind of because the amount of compromises for that probably fatally compromised the bill in ways we'll still see play out over 2 to 4 years. But Taibbi, there's no big scandals for him. I mean, there's tons of scandals, and there's a Russia scandal, but like, America isn't blowing up that many people right now. You know?
Yeah, and I wanted to go on that thread real quick of the whole Russia thing. It's interesting because Taibbi has been one of these, you know, progressive commentators that has really like shied away from jumping on that bandwagon, so to speak. I know he was very critical of how the media covered the Trump dossier. You know, he felt like it was very sensationalistic and tabloidish. And I feel like, you know, that may set him apart from a guy like Greg Palast, too, because, you know, even Greg Palast, right after the most recent U.S. election, Greg Palast was going back to his old, the Republicans rigged the votes or whatever.
Yeah, whereas I mean, I saw...
Taibbi didn't take that tack.
I saw that same thing with, I was looking at Mother Jones recently, and I was like, oh yeah, they're going with another Diebold scandal. And I'm just like, there's not a lot of evidence for that. And Taibbi doesn't take that tack because it fits into Taibbi's narrative that the paranoia in American politics, which is not new. I mean, Taibbi is not the first person to talk about the paranoid style in American politics. It goes back all the way to the 50s, Richard Hofstadter. But that paranoia, you know, he doesn't have a lot of patience for it. And in this election, I remember thinking, like, you know, this is the election where Chomsky, who's always been good about keeping the left from going down these conspiracy tangents, was like, I believe Trump may do this and this and this and this, you know, and manufacture this to start a war to stay. And I'm like, yeah, but none of that's happened yet. And what are you doing, conspiracy mongering? That's not like you. You know, like, we don't have evidence for that. It's really weird to me. But, you know, I've said to you a couple of times that one of the most fascinating things I've seen is how, like, left liberals went from loving RT, Russia Today, to, like, thinking it's, like, Radio Free America, which it kind of is, actually. I used to make that joke. But that, like, now it's all Russia conspiracy and, you know, the evil Russians are trying to take us to... I'm like, even if there was some collusion that rises to a criminal level, the evidence that it actually is the reason why Trump won the election is minimal. And it's really weird because you see progressives like calling for the government to censor Facebook because of scary Russian money. And I'm fascinated by this because this culture of conspiracy is now, it's fully mainstream. And Taibbi's been worried about this for a while. So I think where there really is a touchdown, where you have a point where he actually touches on alternative culture. So what do you make? You know, because you're a bigger Taibbi fan than me. I was pretty snarky when we talked about this. What do you make of Taibbi's critique of American paranoia and the where we are right now?
I was going to say, too, when I was rereading Taibbi's Insane Clown President book for this episode, I actually found myself, you know, in hindsight, disagreeing with him on a few things more than I did when I first read it. So in a way, I probably... become, I'm still a fan of Taibbi on some level in his writing, but, you know, I'm not as enamored with it now. I think what interests me about the critique of paranoia and the paranoid style is just having been around that myself. you know, so long culturally, even from when I was like a teenager. You know, I always tell people I was listening to Alex Jones before it like became popular. I can relate to Taibbi writing about it because it's weird. There's this surreal element to seeing guys like Alex Jones showing up on CNN and Megyn Kelly now, you know, and sort of given this mainstream platform to speak.
But it wouldn't be the first time he's got it, though. I mean, like, in another way, I mean, we forget that, like, you know, someone like Richard Linklater put Alex Jones in a movie in 2001. I mean, if anyone remembers Waking Life.
Waking Life and A Scanner Darkly.
Yeah, he's in both.
I think it's, like, hard to deny that he's really blown up and sort of... I mean, just the way his production has changed, you know. InfoWars has a much slicker look than it used to, so maybe that's why it feels like he's more relevant than he really is. I don't know. But it just seems like characters like that have a bigger megaphone now with the internet. And one of the points in Taibbi's, both The Great Derangement and the Insane Clown President book that I found compelling, and I don't think it's necessarily a profound point, is that you have a lot of people that it's this, like, politics and, you know, counterculture has become a product for them, especially the 9/11 truthers. You know, they each have their pet conspiracy, and they haven't really accomplished anything in regards to their movement. I think the most they've got was the 28 pages last year. But, you know, there's all these conspiracy cultures that have their own little pet topics, and they're really not achieving anything on an activist level. It's almost like I call it the conspiratainment industrial complex.
Yeah, and yet, I mean, what is interesting with this thing with Russia, like, the amount of people, like, if you listen to progressive podcasts, and it's one of these fascinating things that I would love to talk to someone about, is why is YouTube so right-wing and podcasts so center-left-wing? Like, it really is weirdly divided. And it didn't used to be true. When podcasts were first on, they tended to be politically neutral, and then I saw a bunch of right-wing ones. And then I remember, like, Best of the Left and the Young Turks. And I disagree with most of these podcasts, but that perspective is, like, almost ubiquitous on podcasts. Conversely, if you go on YouTube, it's libertarian and alt-right, like, all the way down. And Taibbi, you know, the amount of conspiracy mongering I see right now is pretty amazing. Like, there's all the stuff with the Democrats in Russia. There is the idea that all the attacks on Bill Clinton were manufactured, which still occasionally gets floated around. Although I don't think that has the same pull that it used to. But then there's all this talk on Seth Rich on the right, and like that all these charges against Rory Moore are manufactured and stuff like that. And this is no longer like the fringy right. And Taibbi seemed to have been worried about this as early as 2003. He saw that with the Truthers and the Birthers, you know, both. And I remember reading The Great Derangement. Oh God, when did that book come out? Like 2009, somewhere in there? Like it was right when Obama got elected.
Yeah, I want to say that, yeah.
But he obviously started writing parts of it like as early as 2002 or 2003 because there's references to conventions. And the number of Truthers and like Zeitgeist people, and it's weird because after Occupy, it's like the left is embarrassed by this and we've washed our mind of it. But one of the hosts of our show was a Truther for a large part of his early middle age.
Yeah.
You know, and I remember seeing that back in LJJ's, you know, Loose Change being shared all the time. So... what is Taibbi speaking to? Because you obviously wanted to bring him up, and as a launching point for this alternative culture things, what you have been complaining a lot about the culture war, about, you know, this facile culture war that we all kind of, nobody really, I don't know many people who really love it, even on the far left and the far right, but no one can seem to get out of it. And Taibbi seems to be speaking to a relationship between that culture war and not, but he also seems to be wrong about some things. So I want you to talk about that and maybe what you think he's wrong about in The Great Derangement. Let's get specific.
Well, I was going to say, with what he's wrong about, I was just reading his latest article in the Rolling Stone, and it's called A Year After Trump's Election, Nothing Has Changed. And he goes on this narrative sort of like implying that we're headed towards civil war. And I actually like was like that left a really bad taste in my mouth because I actually don't think we're headed in that direction. And I think that's like very sensationalist. And I really don't think polarization politically is happening nearly as much as people think. It's happening among partisans. I think most people are remaining either apolitical or moderate. At least that's what some of the research I've been reading from Yip Chan Lelks, who is a, I think he's at Penn State, actually, university. A lot of his studies are showing that the polarization is mainly affecting people who are already very partisan.
Right.
You know?
And a lot of research I've been reading actually shows that that's actually amongst a very upper middle class and upper class cadre of people. So, like,
Right.
You know, I know you're not a Marxist like I am, but my vulgar Marxism goes, well, of course, this is just the bourgeoisie's internal bullshit. But I mean, I do think there's some truth to that, that the highly partisan amongst us are actually abnormal. They're loud, and they tend to have a lot of free time for some reason. But when I was looking at a map yesterday about the voting patterns of the country, and what I noticed is that if you factored in the majority doesn't vote, only 6 states in the country show up red or blue, which means 40.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
44 have majority non-participation in the election. And that includes some of the places we think of as like meccas, like Texas for conservatives and California and New York for liberals. I mean, it was literally like Ohio, Wisconsin. I can actually look it up, but it was like the Rust Belt, actually, that had majority political participation. So that's fascinating to me, but it goes with you that, like, I actually also, you know, I live in Salt Lake, and this is a pretty conservative, well, actually, Salt Lake is not. Salt Lake is, like, Western Mountain Sodom compared to, you know, what's immediately around it. But, you know, because we can buy coffee here. That's a joke for people. But this city doesn't, and it's a very blue city with a very red, I mean, extremely red, redder than Georgia, where I'm from, government, right? And yet, I don't see the polarization that I keep on hearing about. And I'm like kind of ground zero for political polarization. I used to be a card-carrying Marxist. I don't have the card anymore. And I find that daily life goes on. People are worried about the tax plan. People are worried about the ACA. And they're worried about the tenor of racism from the government. But they're not actually all that worried about a lot of other things people think they're worried about. But Taibbi's critiquing a bubble that he's also part of, you know, like he's not Hunter S. Thompson. He doesn't do drugs on the side of a mountain in Denver, you know, like he's not hanging out trying to run for mayor with a small town with a bunch of guns. That isn't who he is. He has Hunter S. Thompson's snark, but his lifestyle still seems to be pretty much normal Beltway journalist.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think Taibbi has like really come a long way since he sort of started out, because people, and it's been coming up recently, he just had a few lectures canceled, actually, because of his past writing at The Exile with Mark Ames. I think I mentioned that to you yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Well, The Exile is fascinating. I don't think The Exile has aged well, for one thing. I mean, all those people write well. The only one of those guys that I tend to still read is Jonathan Dolan / Gary Becher.
John Dolan?
Yeah. / Gary Becher, now that Gary Becher, you know, is no longer, is just John Dolan and not his paleo-conservative, you know, persona. And it was funny when I used to read Werner and read John Dolan's paleo-conservative persona, because I knew, A, it was a persona, but B, like, it sounded like me in the same time period. Because I used to say shit like he said. But I don't think they've aged well. I mean, to some degree, even Glenn Greenwald hasn't aged that well. I think of those sort of, like, and he didn't write for The Exile, but of those people willing to critique both sides of the aisle, I think Greenwald aged the best, but even he has made some like pretty big missteps and predictions and stuff over Middle East policy. So what do you think about it? What got him in trouble about The Exile? I mean, like, The Exile's a crazy thing. Also, that makes the Russia thing even funnier, but go on.
Yeah. Well, I guess because a lot of what was written in The Exile was like very sort of like edgelord, you know, type stuff, very like sexual, very, you know, a lot of it's like very politically incorrect for our time. And I haven't like
even though a
read
lot
the
of
book
writers,
that he co-wrote with Mark Ames.
A lot of its writers, it's not just Mark Ames, like I think Connor Kilpatrick.
Yasha Levine.
Yeah, like some of them write for Jacobin and stuff now. So it's not
right.
Most of that coterie is like left-ish. But it's funny because when they talk about like brocialism, you know, and you hear like Chapo Trap House being attacked for that. Like they're actually Chapo, whether they admit it or not, they're operating on a model of commentary that was kind of invented in print by the exiled people, Taibbi, Dolan, Ames,
Right.
To a lesser degree, Connor Kilpatrick. You know, the sort of like early edgelord stuff. And I mean, I'm not going to lie. I loved that stuff when I was 26, you know, 10 years ago.
Yeah,
It was pretty awesome. Particularly when you're like coming, like for me, I was coming out of a period of like pretty stark paleo conservatism in it. And it was a good shock because it still spoke my language, you know. Now I just find it sophomoric and often wrongheaded, actually.
Yeah, I agree. The reason I brought up The Exile is I think the writing of all those guys then was probably much closer to sort of gonzo style journalism than it is now. You know, I think Taibbi's trajectory, along with Ames and the others, I think it's changed a lot since those hazy days. I don't know if you'd agree with that.
Oh, I think that's true for everybody. I mean, like, everybody's kind of fit into their niche depending on their relationship to the Democratic Party or the DSA or whatever. Taibbi, it was just interesting to think about that period to me because one of the things I feel like I'm living with is the ghost of the 90s and the aughts view of politics on millennials. Because the Gen Xers are middle-aged. I'm either the youngest Gen Xer or the oldest millennial myself, like depending on how you read it. I don't know that I know that generational politics matters in that degree, but I do think there is a sort of gradual attitude shift. And the people younger than us on most cohort studies, while they're weirdly paranoid and in all kinds of countercultures, they actually trust institutions more than people in my generation did. Or I say that, I might be their generation too, but people who are my age and a little and older did. Like, I was never...
Like the Gen Xers.
Yeah, like, and right? I'm a transition. I feel like I'm a transition in attitude, but I do not, like, I have a fundamental distrust of the government. You know, as a Marxist, I'm often find myself commenting that so many socialists I know love the government more than they love socialism. And man, does that piss people off. But I often think it's true. And I do think this might be a generational cohort difference. But it's weird now because, you know, everybody's all afraid of the government again because Trump. And yet, I just don't, like, I think Taibbi's in a narrative where he actually buys into the standard Democratic narrative more than you think. I mean, like, when you look at political polarization
studies,
like, they say that people feel more polarized than ever before since the Civil War. And that may be true. They may feel that way if they're politically active, if they're politically motivated. But the other thing that, Joe Biden, I went and saw Joe Biden. People are going to chastise me for that because I'm a Marxist. But I just wanted to hear the old dude speak because he's kind of funny. He tried to humanize Jesse Helms, which was weird. But one of his points, though, was that within the Democratic Party in the 60s, there were still active segregationists and then, like, borderline communists in the same party. And that, like, what they were battling over was as bad as things feel now, substantively more different than what we are battling over. Battling over trans inclusion and all that stuff is important, but, like, we are not in a period of Jim Crow for anybody. Like, even trans people get to vote and whatnot. And I also think Taibbi skirts, another thing that he skirts that, you know, and again, maybe we can try to bring this back to the point of podcast we're talking politics so much. But another thing that he skirts a lot is that I feel like Taibbi treats, like, the evangelical embrace of Trump kind of the way they treated the evangelical embrace of Bush, as if it was a positive thing about evangelical power. And you just get the feeling that these people don't understand what they're fighting. Like, they're not in that world. Like, there's not a cabal of dominionists hiding out trying to influence the Trump administration. I mean, well, there may be around Pence, but they're nowhere near as powerful as they were in 2006. And they weren't as powerful as we make them even.
I think they've lost a lot of power.
Oh, yeah. They've lost a ton. I mean, the reason why they ran to Trump, and I talked to evangelicals. This is a funny thing. I go, I'm the Marxist that evangelicals will talk to on their programs. That I've had a conservative evangelical tell me verbatim that the only reason most of his people supported Trump is that they were afraid of Clinton. They don't like Trump. And that after they did it, that they see, he was disgusted at this, but after they did it, they started embracing Trumpist politics as a defensive posture to justify their own voting patterns. So they were, like, retrospectively Trumpist. But they didn't start that way. It was a reluctance. They would have rather gone for someone like Cruz or Santorum if they could. Or Pence directly.
Right, and that gets at a point that I've made about Dominionists. I actually think that their backing Trump shows how desperate they are.
Oh, yeah.
Because Trump is ultimately a hedonistic casino magnate. And, you know, they ended up backing him. It shows that they're desperate, and I think it shows a lack of power on their part. They're scrambling.
Right. So, I mean, this whole Roy Moore embrace gets a lot thing of that is wrong. The same thing, right? This embrace of Roy Moore. I mean, but and so it's also desperate for the Bannon wing of Trumpism, too, to embrace someone like Warren. Roy Moore doesn't believe in a lot of the stuff Bannon does. Bannon's a Catholic, and Bannon, like, is actually some kind of right-wing Keynesian. Roy Moore doesn't care about economics, and in so much he does, he probably is closer to the Freedom Caucus. I think he just freaks out liberals. I've hated Roy Moore even when I was a paleo-conservative. He's a religious douchebag. And I don't mean that religiousness makes you a douchebag, even. I'm, like, you know, pretty moderate on that count. But he is a religious douchebag. He uses his religion to support his douchebaggery. And I had a Christian professor friend of mine was talking about how he thinks that the evangelical embrace of Trump is really going to hurt them, you know, particularly with stuff like Roy Moore and Roy Moore scandals coming out and the way that, like, they're defending them. They're not even trying to defend his innocence. They're trying to defend the action as defensible even if it's true, which is kind of amazing.
Right.
So what are we saying about alternative cultures here, though? Let's get back. Like, what do you take away from Taibbi that's so informative, not only about our current politics, but, like, in what ways is Taibbi a relic because gonzo journalism doesn't really have this meaning or purpose anymore?
Well, that was another thing I wanted to get into, and I think you've talked about it before, is, you know, Taibbi sort of gets lumped in with the whole gonzo style, but if you actually read his writing, there's not a lot of, like, him placing himself in the story, which is usually what I've always thought gonzo was about.
Well,
you know,
the thing about gonzo
journalist is sort of part of the story.
Well, the thing about gonzo is I've always thought it was like taking Gay Talese or Truman Capote and doing a lot of acid. You know?
Yeah.
Like the difference is, like, it's new journalism, but with more snark and with more drugs. And it was more politically edged than, say, Capote or Gay Talese or even Thomas Wolfe. But essentially, it wasn't that different from that. And I feel like, in some ways, Matt Taibbi actually is functioning in this sort of early 60s reflective journalism that does come out of that edgy, exiled style and this kind of rhymes with gonzo, but isn't the same thing. But even if it was, I still think, like, what does gonzo mean in the age of bloggers? Like, what does it mean when Vice Media is a legit news source? What does it mean, you know, what does it mean now?
Right. It's almost like it's all gone. It's almost like mainstream now, you know.
When CNN seems to be covering Twitter, and it's funny because I find it interesting that, like, media loves Twitter because it increases its own engagement. I mean, that, like, seriously, that's part of why.
Right.
It's part of why it's so loved and so put into the media. But Twitter's will membership numbers has been declining for 2 years. It's not as cultural relevant anymore. Now, the only reason we care about it is because the president's on it and because all these media figures are on it. You know, it's a cesspit, and most people, a lot of people have gotten out of it. But
right.
it does seem to make things like the gonzo snark, you know, that whole edge, that doesn't mean the same thing now. Because, like, dude, we get that all the time. The primary engagement form of the internet is sarcasm.
Snarkiness.
And snarkiness, yeah.
Well, I think that gets at the whole crux of the matter with alternative cultures in the internet age. You know, what really is alternative now when you have, you know, edginess is not really alternative. It's sort of the role of the internet or the role of social media, if you will.
Right. And I have a hard time trying to figure out if we should take social media as indicative of the way people interact, because it doesn't seem to be in my real life, you know, as a teacher and the other things I do. And yet I also know, though, that, like, my students are on social media to the point that they're having new anxiety disorders and increased suicide rates. You know, like, and while we don't know that it's causal, there's a one-to-one correlation. So I find it fascinating, right, that, like, at one end we want to dismiss, you know, the internet as unreal, and at another end we do have to realize, though, that there does seem to be a difference in the way all of us interact, if we really think about it, on the internet, when the way we interact with people in real life. Like, I would never cut someone out of my life for a political argument offline. I might hit them if it got really heated, although maybe not now, 10 years ago, assault seems a lot more likely of an outcome. But you would never just disown someone for it. And you do it on the internet all the time, right? I mean, you don't. You don't, like, in this weird, almost nihilistic commitment you have to openness, but most people do.
Right.
So to bring it back, so we think that alternative cultures and like gonzo journalism is not nearly as useful anymore because it's not an alternative to anything anyway. We're not like tuning in and checking out, right? I mean,
right.
And dropping out. And so like, what is it about? It's just making things more entertaining.
Right.
And yet also with our current sensitivities, and there are a lot of sensitivities to hit. I mean, like I was thinking the other day, and I consider myself a pretty moderate dude when it comes to cultural stuff. Like I don't tend to say a lot of super inflammatory, well I do, but not about things that would get you banned from speaking. But I think now, like, just knowing some of the people I know would probably get me in trouble if I was more famous. And what do you think about that? How is Taibbi not able to answer to that? Like, so we got two different polls with both edginess is irrelevant, but also we have a much higher threshold, or a much lower threshold, for what people consider no platformable offense.
Well, that's interesting because that comes back around to what's happening with Taibbi now.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, he's getting no platformed a lot due to what he wrote at The Exile.
What specifically?
You know, I think it was like accusations of sexual abuse based on what was written in The Exile book. Misogyny based on what Mark Ames and him wrote of their experiences with Russian women. So he's getting like shows canceled and whatnot, lectures. So it's kind of interesting how he came back to that issue of no platforming, because he's sort of, you know, that's back to haunt him now, you know. And this stuff he wrote, I guess he was with Exile in what, like 2001, 2002?
It was shortly after 9/11, I believe. I mean, like it was a long time ago. Because I remember he left The Exile like way earlier than a lot of other people did too, because he got that job at Rolling Stone.
Right.
But it seems like, man, are people take a long time to like to get called out on things, because it's not like casual misogyny hasn't been uncool for, I don't know, since the 70s. Meh, 90s.
Well, it's interesting too, because the first person to point out this stuff with Taibbi and Ames was actually Jim Goad, who is like sort of the internet's alt-right misogynist du jour, you know. So it's there's a certain irony in that. But yeah, it just seems like people really can hone in on things with the internet now, and anything from your past is like very much on record, basically. So anything can come back to haunt you now.
I'm okay with that. You know,
I think it's fair, actually.
You know, as a person who has said and done some outlandish things, I'm kind of okay that. What I found amazing personally is how few people have actually done the research. Like, I remember when a prominent socialist who I won't name wrote a hit piece about me, and like, didn't mention any of the things that he could legitimately hit me for. So he didn't mention my political background, didn't mention, you know, my involvement with the Usta Manifesto, didn't mention all these kind of dumb things I did when I was in my early 20s. And you can find it on the internet. And yet he, like, put the words of someone else on a blog that I also wrote for in my mouth. And I realized, like, one of the weird things about the internet is, like, you know, it's like how they took Milo down. They found this, you know, recording with the Amazing Atheist that wasn't even hidden. It wasn't like it was ever pulled down. It was just there, open for everyone to see, and no one had bothered to bring it up. So
right.
And I feel like that often happens with a lot of these other things. How much do you think that's going to affect alternative cultures? Do you think, like, part of the reason why so many of these alternative cultures are dying is because the mistakes of your early 20s can't be hidden that well anymore. Like, oh, you were a weird-ass Wiccan in 2017. Now that it's 2021 and you need a job, you know, how much do you think that's affected things?
Yeah, I think that's a huge part of it. I also think, like, at times I think people I know have gotten this attitude that there's, like, a lot of younger people I know think there's nowhere else to go with regards to, like, pushing cultural barriers, you know, so.
Oh, there's plenty of places to go.
I think that's part of it, too.
You know, one of the things I'll say is I think, you know, I've read a lot of stuff about how millennials are super liberal. I remember in 2006, all the reporting, and maybe it was earlier than that, maybe it was, like, 2005. All the reporting, the early reporting about millennials were that they were super conservative before the end of the Bush years. Z's coming out the same way. All the things are saying they're super conservative. The kids I teach, they're not conservative at all. They're just apolitical, which I think reads as conservative.
I see that a lot with Generation Z. They're very apolitical, it seems like.
Yeah, but so is millennials for a long time. You know, it was the Great right. Recession that changed all that. My only point about bringing that up is that maybe there is a sense in which both generations are more conservative because they've grown up in a time where your media presence defines who you are, and because of that, they have way more social anxiety. Like, way more. And I know this sounds like an old dude cliche, but I actually can show, because I work in schools, I do, you know, I've been going to workshops with all the objective of, you know, recent sociological studies on American teens and anxiety disorders and suicide rates and the ubiquity of stuff like Snapchat has come up. And, you know, like cyberbullying and blah, blah, blah. Well, I was thinking about this, though. Our political cultures are pretty much cyberbullying writ large. Our political subcultures seem to operate off of a ethos of cyberbullying. And they justify it morally. But what's fascinating to me is I think that comes out of the subculture ethos. I mean, like, you know, the way liberals and conservatives don't engage each other remind me of the way, like, punks wouldn't engage with preppies. But writ large and throughout your entire life.
Right, right. I can see that, yeah. Well, I was going to say, too, with the whole there's no place else to go bit that I was mentioning, I think there are places to go, but I think when people think of alternatives,
mm-hmm.
you know, at least I know, they think 1960s.
Right.
And it seems like a lot of people are stuck in that idea of, well, the counterculture has to be a replication of the 60s in some way, you know, because I think there's a collective memory about the 60s that comes from the boomers that sort of is carried on by millennials in a weird way.
Oh, yeah, it is. I see it in my students who, they love boomer music, and I hear all these people talking about how boomer music was best, and I'm like, no, music now is bad. That does not mean that boomer music was good. Like, your musical taste...
I don't understand boomer music.
Yeah, no, I mean, your musical taste seem to be a degeneration of boomer music, and so boomer music's like, yeah, that's the finest form of American pop rock, I guess, because it's like the earliest articulated where there was any experimentation at all. And you live in an age closer to the 50s where it's all manufactured. But in another sense, it's like, who gives a shit? What I see is just millennials and Gen Xers, and they don't seem to, like, you bring this up when I hear older people chastise them about not engaging with subcultures or trying to create their own art or whatever. They're like, but we're in a market where that's irrelevant, it'll just be co-opted. But I'm like, but everything you're doing has already been co-opted. So, like, yeah, it might just be co-opted.
Right, right.
But
and
like,
I think we even see that with Taibbi. Because Taibbi almost, I think he tries at times to be, like you said, one of these 1960s sort of reflective new journalists. You know, everything, like, harkens back to, like, a previous era, it seems like, with mm-hmm. a lot of commentators now.
Yeah, well, I think that is true. I think there's a whole lot of nostalgia in all this. And
yeah.
It's a nostalgia that in some senses makes sense, but it's also a nostalgia that there's no real answer for. And I think, you know, I think we see that in a lot of contemporary subcultures, too, where, like, they're defined by nostalgia. And one of the things I'll say, though, it's very hard to point out subcultures anymore. Like, even when I started, I've been teaching high school on and off and on since 2006. Yeah, 2006. There was like three subcultures kind of in 2006. There was like normie kids, and they weren't called normie kids, emo kids, and that was really kind of it, and nerds. I go to schools now and you can't even tell those groups apart. And even that was a simplification from when I went to school in the 90s and like things were relatively rarefied. There was like a fashion demarcation line and stuff, and that doesn't seem to be the case at all right now. You know, I was talking to someone my age who was talking about, well, you can't trust people with blue hair, and I'm like, I know normal Mormon girls with blue hair. You know, they have kids and like go to Starbucks twice a week. Like, what? I don't even think that means anything anymore. I was at a party with a bunch of, you know, 5 years younger than me millennials, professionals, and the one thing I noticed, they all were covered in tattoos. And I was like, I mean, you know, I've been abroad for a while. And I was thinking like, huh, this has changed since I left. Because, you know, when I started working as a high school teacher, you couldn't show your tattoos. People had them, but you couldn't show them. And now, like, you know, you just see a bunch of professionals totally tattooed up. No one cares. So the cultural significations
right.
are different. And I can get how younger people today would go, well, that means that there's nothing new for us to do. But that's because their model is not based on a counterculture. It's based on nostalgia. I think that, you know, the 60s counterculture
right.
is greatly overrated to how counter it was to American culture. I mean, half of those people still voted for Reagan.
Right, right. I think too with this whole thing, I've noticed a lot of like younger people that I'm in college with now, it's like you can talk to them about something like the Iraq War and they won't remember the details, right? Mm-hmm. But they'll remember something like Vietnam, you know, which they didn't even live through. But like they have this, you know, they know about it and they want to learn about it. Like they,
oh my God.
You know, there's like an obsession almost. Yeah.
JG, man, I had this realization because I teach media, right? And everyone's like, use more contemporary media to show them stuff because they're, you know. But I did that famous, you know, Viet Cong execution photo. They all knew tons of stuff about Vietnam. When I mentioned the Iraq War, they didn't know anything about it. Nothing. You know, they didn't understand about Occupy. They didn't know the Arab Spring happened. I mean, like, I was like, that would be like me not knowing, you know, when I was in high school, no, I didn't have the details of, like, the Beirut bombing down. But I knew when Isaac Rabin was shot, you know, like, and I, you know, I was not a dumb kid, but it wasn't just me. And one of these weird, right. one of the weird things about the ubiquity of social media and media culture is actually, though, there really isn't a whole lot of understanding of, like, there's no, like, shared media framework. So the kid, people actually just don't know that much.
Right, right. And I think a lot of people have, especially with social media, people are so selective with who their circle is that they sort of create these basically like enclaves where they're not really communicating with anyone outside others who share their beliefs a lot of times.
Right.
You know,
which I think we hear. I mean, I feel like it's common is commented on a lot, but I don't think it's perhaps understood enough.
Right.
But it here's the thing. I also think, though, it leads to a very apolitical thing because everybody thinks there was waiting for something. You know, you see this in left-wing circles, too, JG. Like, you see all these things with people just assuming that 1968's around the corner and we can have it again. You heard this all the time in Occupy. And the more I deal with it, the more I think that is toxic to any understanding of, like, pretty much anything, really. Well, did you have any last notes for us today?
Well, since we were on the 60s, the little, like, 60s tirade just now, I think it's telling that we just had the JFK documents, you know, that big dump released. I think it's very telling of, like, this sort of nostalgia obsession over the past, and especially the 1960s. So maybe we'll have to get into that, like, on a future episode.
Yeah. Okay, so let's tease out some possible episodes in the future. You and I are going to probably talk about, you know what, we need to talk about the rise and perhaps fall of Farrell House Press. And we need to talk about...
Definitely.
And we need to talk about Boomer and 80s nostalgia, because they're related to me. Because I realized today that Boomer nostalgia for the 90s was our nostalgia for the 60s, which somehow we've also given to Millennial and Z kids. But it was a period we never went through, right? And, like, I'm seeing the same thing with the 80s and early 90s with kids now. Like, they know it.
Oh, I'm seeing a lot, yeah.
And I'm like, you know, I'm...
With the 80s especially, just 80s nostalgia.
Yeah, and I want to scream out, kids of the day must defend themselves against the 80s and 90s. You know, like Eddie Vedder did in the 90s about the 70s. Because it's just like, this is someone else's sentimentality. It won't work for you, man. To quote an Eddie Vedder and Mike Watts song. But... really won't work for you now, though, because there's more... I feel like there's more commonalities between the 80s and the 70s in terms of, like, media technology and social organization than there is between the 80s and now. And, yeah, I think we'll end on that note. And so those are our next two episodes, guys. See you around.